Welcome to this special episode of Geheimakte, Secret File 1972. We have decided at short notice to publish it out of order, because actually right now, during summer 2022, a decades-old conflict is about to escalate. Shortly before the 50th anniversary of the Palestinian terror attack against the Israeli Olympic team in Munich, 1972. 11 athletes had been murdered. The conflict that is escalating now is between the families of these athletes and the Federal Republic of Germany. It happened on the 5th of September in 1972, and for September 5th in 2020, the German federal government, along with the state of Bavaria and the city of Munich, are planning a memorial service on site in the Olympic Village. One of those who pushed the planning is Interior Minister Nancy Faeser. She wants to deliver a speech there, how her office confirmed on my request, but all other of my questions were not answered, although there's a lot that has to be clarified. Germany could accept as a matter of fact that its police had failed dramatically. As well, the federal government, the Bavarian government, and the city police. Because they didn't have a plan. Because they rejected help from Israel, where an anti-terror squad stood at the airport waiting for permission to fly to Germany, but the Germans said no. A couple of months earlier, Palestinian terrorists had hijacked a German Boeing 747. They successfully extorted $5 million in ransom money. The Lufthansa chairman sent a courier with a case full of cash to Beirut. This is what happened before Palestinian terrorists assaulted the Israeli Olympic team in Munich. There is also a story in the aftermath. It's again about a hijacked Lufthansa plane, but this will be told in another episode later in this podcast series. This here is about the conflict between the families and the German state. It is about how three different ministries plus the presidential office are jointly trying to solve their problem right on time before the planned memorial service in Munich, which is about to end in a disaster because the families said they don't want to join it. Almost nothing about this conflict is known in public, although it has already lasted 50 years. It started right after the terrorists had killed the Israeli athletes. And now, for the first time, there could be an agreement after 50 years. The issue is a massive political dispute. The commissioner of anti-Semitism of the Bavarian state government, Ludwig Spänle, says some very harsh words about it.
It is a disgrace. At that time, everything went completely wrong. That was a total failure of the state, and everything was hushed up afterwards. And we Germans had practice in collective silence, and since then this problem has simply been pushed aside. It is simply a matter of the Federal Republic of Germany being able to look itself in the face again.
What had been accumulated over the last 50 years is now being negotiated again. That's the story we are talking about here. That is the subject of this special episode.
Geheimakte 1972, 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München.
He said, you know what? You.
Sie haben Terror auf deutschen Boden gebracht.
You brought terrorism on German soil. And he said, no, I cannot tell you because I don't have any information about that. I said, so where is the information?
Es gibt keine Information.
He said, there is no information. I was really furious because the...
Ich war wirklich wütend. Die ganze Art, das sticht aus allem heraus, was ich die letzten 50 Jahre erlebt habe. Diese Frau war so arrogant und es war so demütigend. Das werde ich nie vergessen.
I will never forget that part.
Geheimakte 1972. Die ganze Geschichte. Und die Folgen bis heute. Ein Antenne Bayern Group Podcast von Christoph Lemmer.
Hoch bei September mehr allein. Achadassah, Kulam Zahar.
Sonderfolge 1. Ein alter Streit eskaliert.
Welcome to this special edition. Its title in English reads, An Old Dispute That Escalates. And it's about a police chief, the vice minister, and the struggle with Germany. Let's look back at what happened 50 years ago, because that's when the struggle with Germany began. Two of the Israeli athletes had been shot and tortured shortly after the assault on September 5th. Later that night, Germany offered two helicopters so that the terrorists could escape with their remaining 9 hostages. From the Olympic Village in Munich to the nearby Fürstenfeldbruck airfield. There, the police failed to free them. All of the hostages got shot by the terrorists. The next day, the German authorities brought the surviving team members into a room in an office tower or so, as Anke Spitzer remembers, the wife of the killed fencer André Spitzer.
We had to wait till the next morning.
Back to where?
Back to the place where they kept us with hundreds of policemen. I said, where were you before? I said, you don't have to protect me anymore. And then we spent another night. Those that survived, they were totally hysterical. And then they took us at 6.
Where did you spend the other night?
The whole night in that office where we were put in an office in the tower, you know. So and nobody on the 18th floor. I still remember. And you could not even get out or get in because there were 3 rings of soldiers around this place.
Can you describe that scene? I hardly can imagine how that is. How many people, how many rooms, how many beds or seats or chairs? Or
there were no beds or anything. There were chairs. It was a totally empty room. Not a small room. It was not a hall, but it was a totally bare room. And there were chairs in against the wall. And there were, like, I think, like 7 people who survived. And then we had, of course, the officials, the head of the delegation, the doctor of the delegation, and myself. That was all. And there were no beds. So we spent the whole night there. And all these people that survived, they were crying. There were also 2 girls, 2 athletes, 1 swimmer and 1 athlete. And I just looked at them and I thought, what are they crying for? Because the worst thing already happened. And then we were taken at 6 o'clock in the morning from that. Nobody offered also a bed or something, you know, or something to eat. Or the only thing, the doctor of the Israeli delegation went around with, how do you call it, Valium and things like this, you know, things like this. So at 6 o'clock, we were taken to the airport. And then they told me, go into the airplane, because now we are going to take all the coffins, the zerge, inside the plane. I said, where is the rest of the delegation? Where are the survivors? They're all standing, you know, in an honor, you know. I said, I will stand with them. So we saw that all the coffins were being taken into the plane. And then we went back to Israel. And here I am. I think, where am I going? Baby is in the hospital. André is in the plane, in the coffin. And I, you know, so we got then back to Israel.
An empty room in an office building is provisional accommodation for the night. No bed, no food, no support. 6 a.m. rushing to the waiting plane. Loading the coffins, departure, getting away. And this was kind of how it went over the next 50 years. German authorities didn't even answer Anke Spitzer's questions about how her husband in particular was killed.
I contacted the Minister of the Interior, Bruno Merk. I contacted Manfred Schreiber and also his deputy, Georg Wolf. And I asked them, and I went also to the Institute for Rechtsmedizin, and I asked Professor Spahn, who was the head there, you know, if I could get information.
Fjotl,
All these people that I contacted, they told me that there was absolutely nothing. They don't know what I'm doing here. Go home and cry at home. And I said, I'm not crying here and I'm not crying at home. I just want the information. No, there is absolutely nothing.
Which did not demotivate Anke Spitzer.
I also wrote to the president of Germany. I wrote to the head of the Olympic Committee, Willy Daume, who was then the head. I wrote to every place where you can imagine, also to the Federal Republic, but especially to the Bavarians. From everyone, I got the answer that there is nothing and I should go home and I shouldn't be looking for stuff that isn't there. And I just couldn't accept their answer because I knew there must be a ballistic report, there must be a pathological report, there must be an investigation, what happened to the three terrorists, you know, because this was quite quickly after what happened in Munich, you know.
But for Anke Spitzer, it wasn't enough to just write letters soon. She started to chase German authorities in person.
So you traveled to Germany a couple of times, in particular to Munich, I guess. Do you remember the first time you did this, the first time you went to a plane, flew from Israel, or did you travel from the Netherlands? And how were you? How did that come? How did you arrange that? Was that easy to get an appointment with Manfred Schreiber or Georg Wolf? How did they receive you? What was the room like? Were you sitting or standing?
I did it from Israel, and it was my own initiative. And I did not ask them if they would receive me. I said, I will be coming. And, you know, and I will be coming to your office and I want to talk to you because nobody is answering my letters. So I will be there in person. So this is what I did. I went to the Polizei office of Manfred Schreiber. Of course, they didn't want to let me in the beginning, but I said, I'm going to call some journalists because to tell them that I'm here. And
so let me get it clear. You were traveling to Munich. You were, at the Polizeipräsidium in Munich, you're standing at the door. There was the guardman, and you said, I'm Anke Spitzer, and I want to speak to the police president.
Exactly. That's how it went. And they said, well, you have to make an appointment. You have to this, you have to what? And then you cannot go in. I said, well...
When was that?
That was 5 months after the massacre in Munich, 5 months. It was in the beginning of the next year, and I think the end of January. And they said, well, you cannot just come in. I said, I am going in because I do expect answers to my questions. And they said, no, you have to make a special request. I said, okay, I'm going to call some journalists that will accompany me, and they will write about it, that I'm not being received by the police president, who was head of the rescue team or the, you know, the Krisenstab. So then they let me in and I met him and he was very, very not nice.
Him is Schreiber or Wolf or both?
No, it was Schreiber. And I said, okay, and who was in charge of the rescue operation at Fürstenfeldbruck? And he said, it's Georg Wolf, my deputy. I said, okay, from your office, now I'm going to meet Mr. Wolf. And he said, yeah, but you have to arrange that. And so I said, I don't have to arrange anything. You didn't arrange anything. So I'm just going to go to his office and I want to talk to him. And I did. And I think they were a little bit, they didn't understand my actions, I think, but I couldn't care less. You know, I was, like I said, I was young and very angry. So I went to Georg Wolf's office. It was in the same building at that time. And he let me in, and he asked, what are you doing here? I said, well, you did not answer my letters, so I came personally to hear your answer. And he said, what is it that you want to know? I said, I have a few questions. And one of the questions is, when you were at the Fürstenfeldbruck airport and you had some sort of plan with the Lufthansa plane and the terrorists were supposed to fly with their captives, with the Israeli team, with that Lufthansa plane to an Arab country, you know, you had a plan that you put 14 policemen inside the plane, and they were supposed to overpower the two leaders of the Palestinians. And then the other ones would come out and see why they're not coming back, and then you would take care of them. But I said, that was your plan, right? And he said, yes. I said, okay. And before the helicopters landed in Fürstenfeldbruck with the terrorist and the Israelis, all the policemen who were supposed to overpower the Palestinians, they fled. They left the airplane because they said they had the talk between themselves. They had a referendum and they said, we are not equipped. We were supposed to be police officers and for traffic. And we have no idea how to use weapons or how to, what to do with these very well equipped Palestinian terrorists. We are just going to be shot and let's leave. And they left the airplane. And I said, so what was your plan B then? Because this didn't work. This plan didn't work. Because they already left before it even started. And he said, we didn't have a plan B. I said, okay, and then why did you allow those police officers to leave the plane? And then he looked at me and he said, I looked into their eyes and I saw that they wanted to live. And that's why I let them go. And I said, and did you look in the eyes of my husband, who was 2 minutes later in the helicopter with his hands tied and with his friends there? And did you look into his eyes as well? Because do you think he did not want to live? He didn't want to be with me or with his little baby daughter. So he just wiped me away with his hand. And he said, you know what? You. And then he pointed at me. I said, you brought terrorism on German soil. I said, what? Me? And he said, no, not you, but the Israelis, they bring terrorism on German soil.
But this wasn't all. The conversation with Munich's police chief wasn't over yet. She had to answer on what she heard, she says.
My husband and his friends, they came to the Heitere Spiele. They came to be part of the Olympic dream of brotherhood and peace and friendship. They did not come with weapons or they did not come as soldiers. They came as athletes. They came to your Olympic Games and you were supposed to protect them. So they did not bring terror on German soil. Whoever brought terrorism, at least talk about the Palestinians. And he said, well, these were freedom fighters. I said, again, these Palestinian terrorists were, yes, they were freedom fighters. So I understood that Mr. Wolf was not exactly going to listen to me or give me answers, and I left his office.
Try to guess if Anki Spitzer continued chasing German authorities. Of course she did. The police office wasn't the only one she targeted. Next was the coroner. She names the coroner's office as pathology or by its German name, Rechtsmedizin.
And then I came back again 2 weeks later. I took another plane from Israel to Munich, and then I wanted to go to the pathological institute, the Rechtsmedizin Institute with Professor Spahn. And I said, maybe he can tell me, because nobody could tell me in what helicopter my husband was. Was he shot at .000? Or was he in the other helicopter exploded and was he burned? Maybe you think, you know, why do you want to know this? I want to know this. I have the right to know this. And I just want to know. And so I went to him. He did receive me, although I did not, I wrote him several times, but he let me in. And then he said to me, we have nothing here. I said, but you did the abduction, didn't you? He said, yes, not of all of them, but most of them. So I said, what did you find? What can you tell me? Can you tell me what happened to my husband, André Spitzer? And he said, no, I cannot tell you because I don't have any information about that. I said, so where is the information? He said, there is no information. We just did the abduction, and then the next morning they were taken to Israel because there is a custom in Israel that you bury people when they are from Jerusalem, people die, they are buried the same day. And people who are outside of Jerusalem, they are buried the next day. So they had to do it quickly, hop, 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 because the Israelis, they pressured us to do it quickly so they can take the coffins back to Israel for burial. I said, okay, so you did it quickly, but what did you quickly? Show it to me, show it, let me know. Is it somewhere written what happened to André Spitzer? And he said, no, 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 we have nothing. So now I have no time anymore, he said, so I had to leave.
After that, Professor Spahn stopped the conversation and said that he didn't have any time left for this. I was not able to confront him with what Anki Spitzer said because he died in 2013 at age 92. He was a highly decorated coroner. However, he blocked all further efforts Anki Spitzer made to learn more about her husband's fate. Twenty years later, we are now entering the 1990s. Anki Spitzer still struggles to get the information from Germany, but doesn't succeed. One day she's being interviewed in a German TV show. She complains about the German authorities and their lack of interest in opening up their files and providing her with what she wants to know. But after this TV show, something surprising happens.
And then one person contacted Ilana and myself and they said, I saw you on television and you're absolutely right. I work in the archiven, in the archives in Munich. And he said, you're absolutely right because I know that there are thousands of files and there are hundreds of pictures. I said, very nice that you say that, but why should I believe you? I said, if you want it, prove it to me. So he did. A week later, I got this big brown envelope and he literally stole out of the archives 80 pages. Little bit of the ballistic report, little bit of the pathological report and a little bit of the investigation.
This wasn't much, but it was a beginning. These small samples were enough to startle the officials.
There was so much noise that we are just telling stories. So I was invited to be again in a TV show of the ZDF. And I was in the studio here in Tel Aviv. And they invited the Minister of Justice, Margrethe Berchtesgaden. And she came also to the studio. And the moderator asked her, I said, there are all these talks. And here Anki Spitzer is in the studio in Tel Aviv. And you are here, and she claims that you have still more information, and why don't you give it to her? And then she said, well, I don't think she has any information, because we don't have any information. Then I said, well, maybe you can change your mind, because I have here the ballistic report. I only had like 16 pages of the ballistic. I said, if you go to page 7 and you go to alinea 2, it's written ta-ta-ta-ta, and I quoted from the little paper that I had. Said the moderator, she seems to have. I said, no, but it's not all. You know what, Mrs. Minister, you go back to your archives and then maybe you look at the pathological files, you know. Then you find on page 17, at the end of the page, it's written David Berger, what kind of bullets he got and where he got it and everything, you know. And I just quoted from the paper.
This was tough. The Bavarian Minister of Justice had to admit that there are files, although all state entities had denied this over more than two decades. At this point, Anki Spitzer and the other families of the killed athletes have had enough. They decided to sue Germany. But they didn't have the necessary budget for lawyers and fees to do so. Luckily for them, an anonymous spender granted their effort. They sued Germany, but lost two times. In both cases, the judges said they were too late. The case had been outdated. They decided to prepare a legal action at the German Constitutional Court, but again, didn't have the money to do so.
That was a major problem. A major problem, because I'm talking about millions, which we didn't have. I didn't even have 10% of that. So, but we succeeded, and we chose one of the lawyers, Professor Dr. Henschel, and he took the case, and he said, we are going to reverse this statute of limitations, we're going to reverse the Ferriero, and I'm starting to work on it.
But then, surprisingly, the German Vice Minister of the Interior contacted her. This was in the year 1999. It was during the reign of Social Democrat Chancellor Gerhard Schröder. This vice minister was Mrs. Brigitte Tsipras. Anki Spitzer says Tsipras had told her that she would never succeed in a lawsuit at the highest German court. It would be better for her to negotiate with the German government. The families of the killed Israeli athletes came together and made a decision not to take the risk to lose a third court case, but to negotiate. They sent Anki Spitzer as their delegate to Berlin, 27 years after the Munich massacre. When she arrived there, were representatives of the state of Bavaria and the city of Munich, and on behalf of the Federal Republic of Germany and negotiation leader Brigitte Tsipras.
And then she said, okay, we are here and we just want to know why you want money. I said, you took us out of court. You did not let us continue. You have a reason why you didn't do that. Because you're afraid of what is coming out of all this, you know. So what do you have to offer? She said, well, we are going to talk about this and we are going to see what we can offer you as a gesture. It's not compensation, a gesture. And you can go back to Israel and we keep you posted and tell all the journalists downstairs who are waiting for you, if you are going to talk to them, then the whole deal is off. I said, do you think I invited the journalist in front of the Innenministerium? I said, I didn't say a word to anyone. Nobody knows that I'm here. So you probably invited them. And now you're threatening me if I'm going to talk to them that there is no deal. I said, good day. And I left. And I was really furious because her attitude, I still stands out in my last 50 years. It was so arrogant. It was so humiliating. And I will never forget that part.
Anki Spitzer confronted Tsipras with an allegation that Germany conspired with the Palestinian terrorists group PFLP to arrange a fake plane hijacking to get the three surviving terrorists out of Germany who were arrested in Bavarian prisons. Germany allegedly paid the terrorists $9 million.
How did Brigitte Tsipras react when you confronted her with the $9 million to George Habash?
She never reacted to the fact that I said, you know, it's more profitable to be a terrorist because they got $9 million.
Did she deny what you said when you said that Germany paid $9 million to George Habash?
No, she didn't deny it, but she didn't react to it, you know, and she took it as a very not nice saying of me that it is more profitable to be a terrorist.
Can this really be true? I confronted Brigitte Tsipras with what Anki Spitzer says and asked her for an interview. She declined. Instead, she sent me an email writing this.
Dear Mr. Lemmer, I do not remember any such reproach. Yours sincerely, Brigitte Tsipras.
And about her negotiations she had with Anki Spitzer, Tsipras writes in another mail.
Dear Mr. Lemmer, it is now 23 years ago when we had the talks with Mrs. Spitzer. I do not have any notes in private. It's all within the files of the Federal Ministry for the Interior. Following my memory, there was a dissent about how much money the families of the victims already had received. The federal government had paid, but it was contentious what part of this the families had received, and if not, whose fault that was. For sure, I did not threaten her. Mrs. Spitzer was presenting herself as highly committed and had involved the media to emphasize her position by going public. Possibly I told her that such behavior could be contraindicated. At least this was my conviction as well during other meetings. For all your other questions, please refer to the Ministry of the Interior. Best sincerely, Brigitte Tsipras.
Of course, I sent my questions to the Ministry for the Interior as well. What was the reason for the government at Brigitte Tsipras to negotiate with Anki Spitzer? Why this late, 27 years after the Munich massacre? Was the planned court trial at the German High Court amongst the reasons? Well, the answer I received was a short email, just this.
The Ministry of the Interior basically does not comment on non-public negotiations and lawsuits, and also not about any statements by former employees, including vice ministers.
And today, the dispute is still not solved. Just a couple of days ago, new negotiations started. The families have two demands, of which one of them now seems to be fulfilled. Just now, the German government accepted that Germany holds responsibility for the killing of the Israeli athletes for not properly protecting them. This is new. Germany didn't do that all over these 50 years. The second is a financial compensation for the families. Germany would be willing to pay some money, but based on national measures only, says family's attorney Alexander Knop, an expert in international law based in Amsterdam. He claims this is wrong and refers to an expertise he sent to the German government.
We have explained in this expert opinion, it's purely based on international law, that's to say, jurisprudence of international courts, literature, other UN resolutions, that the Munich attack was clearly of an international dimension. That is to say that Germany cannot rely on national compensation standards.
I confronted the foreign ministry in Berlin with this opinion. Instead of an answer, I received a statement from people around Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock. This.
This is false. The foreign ministry doesn't know of any such categories. The wordings local incident and international attack are no legal categories that could trigger legal consequences.
Knop, at least professor for international law in Amsterdam and Yan'an, China, with an impressive list of publications and networking memberships, obviously has a different view as the German government.
We say, on behalf of the families of the 11 victims, Germany, the compensation standard you should apply here should be based on the fact that the Munich attack was an act of international terrorism. We say there are five factors, there are five components why the Munich attack in 1972 should be legally qualified as an act of international terrorism and not just as a national act. First, the perpetrators were clearly Palestinians. Second, the facilitators of this attack pertain to the state of Libya. And this is based on a research we did with our team, which culminated in 2019 in an expert report, which we also provided to the Israeli government. Now, the third factor why the Munich attack was undoubtedly transnational in nature was that, thirdly, the victims were of Israeli descent. Fourth, the attack took place at the most prominent international sports event, namely Olympic Games. And fifthly, and this is a new detail, this document reveals for the first time in all those 50 years it was withheld by the German government, that one of the demands of the terrorists was the release of Ulrike Meinhof. Ulrike Meinhof was at that time part of the movement Black September.
Ulrike Meinhof was a left extremist German terrorist with ties to Palestinian groups, and at the time of the Munich attack, imprisoned in Germany. Knop compares other international terror attacks and compensation that had been paid in these cases.
For instance, in the Lockerbie attack in 1968, above the Scottish village Lockerbie, the Pan Am flight, whereby 270 passengers died, whereby Libya ultimately awarded, under pressure of the United Nations, $2.7 billion. Families were awarded each $10 million per victim, $10 million per victim. The terrorist attack in West Berlin, in the Club La Belle, 1986, each victim received $3.5 million. The attack on the UTA flight 772 in 1989, there was an award of $1 million per victim. And the massacre in the airport Lod, LOD, in 1972, this resulted in a compensation per family of $22.2 million.
Knop also says the amount expresses some valuation to the victims' families. They all were traumatized forever, and the Munich attack in 1972 against the Israeli Olympic team had an even stronger impact, since the family never had been accepted as victims of international terrorist crime so far and left alone over five long decades. In sharp contrast to the victims of the other attacks, who had been fully recognized and compensated shortly after. What State Secretary Ludwig Spänle from Bavaria comments like this.
It must be acknowledged that the German state has failed here and has to apologize. I think the announcement that a joint commission of historians will be set up is the right step. And finally, it is a shame that 50 years after assassination, the families have to struggle for adequate compensation, like supplicants. Here, it is the duty of the German state to find an adequate solution.
Hier steht der Staat in der Pflicht, eine adäquate Lösung zu finden.
The process with Germany and the families of the killed Israeli athletes is about to be continued and may be solved within the following days. September 5th is coming closer, and so is the planned memorial service in Munich. It would be kind of a disaster for Germany and internationally recognized if the families really would boycott it. It is to be heard that the German government is about to release a new offer until August 15th. So this was our special episode within the series Geheimakte 1972, Secret Files 1972. To cover the current news topicality and to explain what's behind it. Next, we return to our regular schedule. Our next episode is about how the Palestinian terrorists have been recruited and equipped. It's based on the interrogation protocols of the three surviving terrorists and files from German police and secret services. It's about Issa and Tony, the two operational leaders. You like this podcast? Consider writing a review, sharing it with your friends, or clicking like or full 5 stars. You feel you have something to contribute? Contact me via email to geheimakte@antenne.de.
Geheimakte 1972. 50 Jahre nach dem Olympia-Attentat in München. Ein Podcast der Antenne Bayern Group.